Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's Fourth Branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Welcome to today's episode of the Regulatory Transparency Project's Explainer podcast series. We're fortunate enough to be joined again today by Jennifer Hulston, Research Fellow at Mercatus, and Ashley Baker, Director for Public Policy at Committee for Justice. And we're here today to talk about something called BIPA. But before I get started, I want to just do one note to our audience. We just finished up the National Lawyers Conference here at Federalist Society, and we were heartened to get a number of people coming up to us and giving us feedback about the new podcast series, that you were enjoying it and had been sharing it around with your law school colleagues. So we just want to appreciate our audience for letting us know that and look forward to providing you additional content like our episode today. So on that note, I'll get us started. Jennifer, what is BIPA?
So BIPA stands for Biometric Information Privacy Act. And typically when people say BIPA, they're referring to an Illinois law, although we do see similar laws in a couple of other states. This law is a little over a decade old. It was passed in 2008 and concerns a series of regulations for the retention, collection, and use of biometric information within the state. So that could be things like facial recognition and photo tagging. It could also be the use of fingerprints as an identifier and several other of these really recently emerging technologies.
And what makes BIPA particularly unique is that it has a federal, it has a private right of action. And with the private right of action, a private citizen can bring suit for infractions of the law. And that infraction doesn't have to, there doesn't have to be a demonstration of harm. There just has to be a violation of the law. And per infraction, it can be between $1,000 and $5,000 penalty, depending on whether it's from negligence or recklessness or, you know, intentional violation of the law. So essentially, the enforcement mechanism of BIPA is the private right of action, which has made it particularly ripe for litigation abuse and plaintiffs' attorneys pursuing class actions under BIPA when harm doesn't have to be demonstrated. The law's really flown under the radar for the past 10 years, so there's some very simple, you know, uses of technology, such as, you know, scanning into buildings with fingerprints, and other things that were not taken into a, this law was not taken into account until now.
So it sounds like there's some specific litigation that's come up related to this law. Could you tell us a bit about those cases and what they might mean for the future of this technology?
Absolutely. So as Ashley mentioned, we have seen kind of a gradual increase in the number of lawsuits related to BIPA, particularly class action lawsuits, but also more generally litigation under this law. One of the most recent examples we saw was in the Illinois state courts, and it was a case involving Six Flags. Now, you might not think of an amusement park as something where biometric privacy would be an issue, but Six Flags, like a lot of other places now, was using fingerprints to link annual passes to the user, in part so that, say, I can't give Ashley my annual pass. She shows up to Six Flags and claims she's Jennifer. No one checks an ID at the gate. Instead, now, to have a speedier entry, to allow people to ensure that the right person is using the right annual pass, several companies have gone to, say, using fingerprints or using other forms of recognition. Well, a 14-year-old signed up for, went to pick up an annual pass, and they took his fingerprints, and he went home and he told his mother, who I think we can safely assume was a little upset about this based on the fact that they're the plaintiffs in the suits, and they brought a case against Six Flags for statutory violations of BIPA. What was interesting about the court's ruling in this case is that there was a lot of back and forth about whether or not there had been actual harm, you know, whether or not something had happened because of this collection to have a real cognizable harm, an economic harm, a physical harm, things that we typically look for in tort cases. And what the Illinois State Supreme Court found was that under BIPA, because of the private right of action, that a statutory infraction was sufficient, that you didn't have to take that next step when it came to harm.
And now, thanks to the wonderful Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, these plaintiffs have standing in federal court as well. BIPA gave them standing under state law. Now they have federal standing. One of the hurdles to Article III standing was a Supreme Court case from 2016, Spokio, which said that material harm had to be demonstrated. Now, under the Ninth Circuit ruling, the class has standing under federal court because the Ninth Circuit ruled that just the collection of that data constituted harm, which is kind of a interesting concept because what kind of brought about these suits, especially in the Ninth Circuit, is Cambridge Analytica. They didn't, you know, there was no harm before that, so was there really harm? And this suits against Facebook, it could be up to $35 billion in penalty, which is, you know, no drop in the bucket and a huge reward for plaintiff's attorneys.
And I think a lot of times when we hear biometric information, it may come across as something that's exceptionally sensitive and that people are really concerned about. But for example, the case in the Ninth Circuit involved photo tagging and what the defaults for photo tagging should be and recognizing and things like that. So this is a technology many of us have come to expect that basically could open the floodgates to a lot of litigation if this type of view of these laws goes forward.
And some of the things that are considered biometric identifiers under BIPA, because this was passed in 2008, so things have come a long way since then, such as automatic recognition of, you know, photos on Facebook. It's even just face geometry, which could be, you know, a picture and an ID to get into a building, for example. What constitutes biometric identifiers is just very, very broad under BIPA.
To what extent is this also, because of the nature of social media and the internet and these companies, it becomes a regulatory quagmire because one state's decision to regulate in one way basically forces it upon, you mentioned this is a Ninth Circuit case, but Illinois isn't in the Ninth Circuit, so it got there because Facebook is a California company providing services basically nationwide. So to what extent is that part of the difficulty here? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but there are other states with these laws, and how do you see that playing out as far as the different regulatory schemes?
Well, in some cases, because of how specific this law is and because it is within Illinois, we've seen companies choosing not to offer certain products or service there. They've been able to geofence it out previously. For example, when Google did the art selfie match, they were able to geofence out Illinois, and Illinois residents couldn't take part in the fun when that went viral. But I think it'll be an interesting question, particularly given if this Ninth Circuit ruling goes forward, whether or not that continues to be an option.
Yeah, and Jennifer's right. Companies now have to take into account what states they can and cannot operate in under, you know, such laws. But in terms of the litigation abuse kind of spreading, so to speak, you know, plaintiffs' attorneys are very creative and have found other forums, of course, for this. So that's, you know, that's affected other jurisdictions as well.
Got it. What are I think we've spoken a little bit about what may or may not be allowed under this law. Are there any other practical effects from this, things that may not be available in Illinois or other states that have laws like this that we might think are more commonplace?
So Nest cameras are not allowed in Illinois. They don't operate there. So, and also, I think 90% of the suits brought under BIPA are related to employers using fingerprints of employees or other biometric identifiers for access to buildings or to check in and out of work. And that's something that's, you know, a lot more convenient, a lot more secure. So as, you know, having a Nest camera that protects your home. So here we have an issue where, as a result of this class action abuse, people are less safe and consumers do have a lot less options. One of the more recent cases actually involved a senior citizen's home that used biometrics to identify their employees. And at the end of the case, too, the members of the class, the former employees, were compensated, I think, around $650 or so each. The legal expenses going to the attorneys was a bit over $500,000.
Wow. Well, what comes next? What do you think is it sounds like there's some state-level legislation in the works and maybe some federal as well.
I think that the experience with BIPA can show two things. One, it can show the impact that a single state can have on the availability of technology as well as on the development of the law around these technologies. So as we look at broader data privacy, as we look at states like California passing the California Consumer Privacy Act, the CCPA, other states considering similar actions, it shows that it's very rare that those are just truly isolated, given the nature of technology today, to that one state. Additionally, there's been an increasing conversation around should private right of action be included in these broader data privacy laws? And if so, what would the harm look like? And I think that these recent cases can kind of provide a cautionary tale of how difficult that harm can be to define and the concerns of how litigation could not necessarily remedy some of these concerns, but instead provide a barrier to future innovation.
Yeah, I think the big takeaway with BIPA, you know, as a precautionary tell is having a class action as an enforcement mechanism for a regulation is just inevitably going to lead to abuse. And that's essentially what it amounts to. Even in the Six Flags case, kind of one of the more notable aspects was that it explicitly acknowledged that the law's enforcement mechanism was the private right of action. And that's particularly dangerous, I think. There's one issue regarding, you know, what this means for tort analysis and not having to show harm. But there's also kind of a broader fight going on as well regarding regulation through litigation. And when, from you know, a practical standpoint, if you know, a federal bill were to pass that had a private right of action, you would see a lot of class action suits filed immediately. And the class action would happen right a long time before the regulation was actually implemented.
So it sounds like there's sort of two elements to Illinois' BIPA law that problematic, maybe too strong of a word, but there's the private right of action that other states' BIPA laws don't have, and then there's the lack of requirement to show any form of harm. In the other states where there is regulation of biometric capture information, but there isn't either a private action or there is a requirement to show harm, what does that regulatory scheme, enforcement scheme, look like? In other words, what are the alternatives that if we're trying to create a federal version of this law, what are some of the alternative regulatory schema that might be able to be used?
Okay. You see with CCPA, for example, it does not have an express private right of action. The amendment to that failed. It could be later amended. Who knows? But you already see the possibility of suits arising for CCPA infractions under unfair trade practice laws in California. So there are ways around these things. And a lot of this, you know, if it's in a federal bill, it doesn't really necessarily matter. And you'll have, you know, these bills such as BIPA, and if we don't have federal preemption and federal bill, then, you know, these bad laws still, state laws still stand in addition to the federal law.
Right.
I would also just add that I think it's notable that the majority of that the cases we're talking about are all based off of the Illinois law, that it's different than when you're having an enforcement of an infraction. And while that certainly can have consequences on innovation or the availability of some of these products, it's a bit more certainty and it's not as it there's a bit more certainty and there's less risk in some ways with regards to what was decided. The interesting thing with the private right of action element is particularly once the court found this kind of very broad definition of harm, that the mere collection of this data could constitute harm as a statutory violation, that opens a lot more risk for companies that may be thinking about doing innovative and creative things that could benefit consumers as a whole. I also think it's interesting in that it shows that a single state's private right of action can kind of change the dynamics when it comes to the law around this. So as Ashley mentioned, the CCPA does not have an express private right of action in it, at least currently. But some of the laws that have been discussed in other states that haven't passed have considered having a private right of action. So regardless of what happens on a federal level, even a single state choosing to have a private right of action in a broader consumer data privacy law could have real consequences when it comes to the ability to deploy some of these products nationwide.
And there's also right now a New York State comprehensive federal privacy law that's being considered that does have a private right of action. It seems that maybe they're learning a bit from BIPA in terms of the debate that's going on there. But really right now what we're facing is, you know, the trade-off in the Senate, the national privacy bill.
Interesting. Is there any arguments that have come up from a dormant commerce clause direction? This seems a lot like seems like there's some parallels here with the interstate commerce that goes on through social media and these national social media companies that would make them, like you mentioned, the geofencing for some of the tagging. It makes it very, you know, these companies are now burdened with trying to figure out when people are in the state of Illinois or not in the state of Illinois. And there's probably questions about when someone's an Illinois citizen but is out, you know, in Texas or something like that. Have we seen any policy or any legal arguments come up from a dormant commerce clause argument that this should be, that basically you might be able to regulate, for example, biometric record keeping inside the state where it's kept, you know, recorded there and kept there, but something that's crossing state lines or, you know, crossing multiple state lines in the case of servers and that kind of thing. Has there been any policy or legal arguments that you've seen coming from that angle?
Yes, but these are two very different issues. To clarify, one's a Commerce Clause issue, the other one's, you know, an Article 3 standing issue in the court. So there have been dormant Commerce Clause issues, which Jennifer can elaborate on a bit, but these things aren't directly related to one another.
I think we've seen more discussion of that in the kind of broader consumer privacy laws that are coming about, but particularly given the more recent Ninth Circuit action, I think that there are increasing concerns about even these more, what might appear specific directed privacy laws' ability to impact cross borders. You know, at what point does it become not viable to just say, well, you can't offer this product in Illinois, and at what point is that enough of a burden to overcome any purported benefits of the law? Of course, whenever we're talking about privacy, it's always an issue with trying to quantify certain things. And I think that certainly will be an interesting thing to watch in this space in general, because the internet by its very nature is interstate. I mean, it's very difficult to even maintain within national borders these distinctions when it comes to different regulations. But to try and do it on a state-by-state level, and even, you know, if localities get involved, one can imagine a world where certain cities might want to have their own regulation of certain types of data. It very quickly becomes such a patchwork of different issues that effectively it can make it impossible to offer a product everywhere or to really engage in interstate commerce.
And it's worth pointing out, too, that companies would be particularly risk-averse with the private right of action. I mean, you know, it's one thing, all the compliance cost under the regulations under CCPA and any of the other state laws, you know, that adds up to a fair amount, but that's nothing compared to litigation cost, which can be particularly impactful on, you know, small and mid-sized companies who can't afford to litigate.
I also think it is important to note, because I know we've talked a lot about the dangers of litigation in this particular episode, but certainly common law can have a role to play when we're talking about things like the definition of harm and when we're talking about things like establishing standing. So it's by no means to say that everything needs to be done through top-down legislation. I think what we're trying to point out here is the risk of, particularly when you have a private right of action without those clear parameters on it of what can happen.
Yes, like I said, if that's the enforcement mechanism, then it's going to be abused. You know, litigation surrounding this does have its place whenever there is harm that you can demonstrate. But when that's, you know, something that's as easily abusable as this is now, then that will inevitably happen.
Jennifer, Ashley, thank you so much for coming in and giving us a follow-up episode on this issue.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.